Whale. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of our good friend William Grieg, and I don't know what William's going to talk about, but I just want to mention that, of course, the celebration of the or acknowledgement of the 10-year anniversary of the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center is coming up in just a couple of days. This is the 9th, and this will be on, I guess, on Sunday. Of course, they're going to ban any mention of Christianity, any prayer or anything during this acknowledgement. We're going to have Buddhists there. There are going to be people from all the other religions, but nothing, no acknowledgement of Christianity. And this, of course, is the edict of Mayor Bloomberg. Mayor Bloomberg is an anti-Christian bigot. But he's doing this to promote anti-Semitism, because by so doing it, he tends to convince a lot of people that it's the Jews are behind everything. Bloomberg is playing his part very well. This is not a Jewish conspiracy, I can assure you that. It is a satanic conspiracy. It is built upon an intense hatred of God. And Mayor Bloomberg of New York is an anti-Christian bigot who hates the God of the Bible. And I suspect he hates the God of Judaism as well. Well, this is the time, though. I would just want to say, if you have any question what happened that morning on that afternoon of September 11th, please go to your computer and type in YouTube, Ed Asner, the member of Mary Tyler Moore fame, YouTube, Ed Asner, Building Number 7, and you'll see a number of links to a video that's put forward by the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, when you see Building 7 come down. And you watch that two or three times, you'll be convinced, as I am, that Building 7 coming down was a controlled demolition. No question, it was a controlled demolition. I know now, of course, that many people who've spoken out and tried to get the truth out have been threatened, and, of course, at least one of them I know has been killed. I suspect others have been killed. Certainly our friend Michael Rupert, they poisoned him, but they didn't kill him. But other people have been threatened because they've tried to get the truth out. But I hope you'll go to YouTube, Ed Asner, Building 7, watch Building 7 come down. And it is obviously a controlled demolition. Well, if Building 7 was a controlled demolition, then everything you have been told about what happened that day is a lie. But why should you be surprised? They lied to you about what happened at the Gulf of Tonkin incident, and they said 58,000 American boys to fight and bleed and suffer and die in Vietnam in a war we were never allowed to win. We were forced to lose. Well, that is a background, and acknowledging that the 10th anniversary of the attack on the World Trade Center is coming up. The question is, who was really behind this? And certainly, we won't get into how they did it, but we can ask the question, have we been told the truth? If you watch Building 7 come down, you realize we haven't. William, what are we going to talk about tonight?
I think that's a pretty good subject for discussion, Dr. Stan. And thanks again for having me on your program. It's always an honor and a privilege and a blessing to be with you. What's happening, I think, is properly characterized, as you most likely inadvertently did, as a celebration. The regime is celebrating an accomplishment, and that accomplishment is to reconfigure our lives in such a way that we are defined by what we fear. And that's what rulers always want to induce within the minds and hearts of those they presume to rule. They want us to be afraid. They need us to be afraid. And they need to channel that fear and catalyze it and transmute it into a weapon to take our freedoms from us. And they've been singularly successful in that pernicious task.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with William Grieg. And I think his point is well made. William, go right ahead.
You're probably familiar with Salon.com. It's an online magazine of sort of a vaguely leftist and Democratic-aligned sensibility. It's been around for about 15 years now. They've been doing a steady series of articles building up to what we can characterize as the celebration of 9/11. One of them has to do with works of fiction and other cultural artifacts that were inspired by that terrible morning. And they ask the question, what are the five worst pieces of literary fiction inspired by the events of Black Tuesday? And that list is adequate, but there's one conspicuous omission. I would consider it to be the greatest work of fiction omitted from that list to be the official 911 report, the official 9/11 report that contains the establishment version of what happened that day. And, of course, this is something that was written by a panel hand-selected for the purpose of conducting a cover-up. You had Mr. Keene heading up the commission because Henry Kissinger was forced to recuse himself. I think Kissinger's presence on that panel would have been just a bit too heavy of a tip-off as to what was going on, that they were creating a official narrative, an official narrative that was completely at variance with the truth. I mean, anytime Kissinger shows up, you know that the truth is going to be banished from the room because he simply cannot abide the presence of the truth. But what we've been seeing over the last 10 years, and I'm indebted to my friend and somebody I regard as one of my heroes, Lou Rockwell of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, for this insight. What's happened over the last 10 years is that the United States entered into what he calls the Fifth Republic. What Lou Rockwell has written is the following. If we were as honest as the French, we would admit that there have been at least five U.S. republics. The first was founded in 1789 in the centralization and empowerment of government in the Constitution. The second came with the increased centralization under Lincoln. The third was established under Wilson with World War central banking, the income tax, and the centralizing 17th Amendment. That's a very important point, by the way. The 17th Amendment effectively abolished the Senate. The Senate was supposed to be the voice of the discrete sovereign states in the Constitutional Confederation. That was done away with the 17th Amendment, and there have been a lot of things that have gone seriously wrong in our polity because of that. Then Lou Rockwell continues, the Fourth Republic was founded by FDR with his fascist New Deal and another world war, and the Fifth was born on 9/11 of 2001. Now, I'll admit, continues Lou Rockwell, these are arbitrary. One could add Truman, LBJ, Nixon, and others. Every single U.S. president has left the government more powerful than he found it. Also note that I use the president's name to symbolize the oligarchy of government, as if government were personal, as in the ancient world. Of course, the president is just a campaign button on the lapel of the plutocracy.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with William Gregg here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly William was just quoting Lou Rockwell as pointing out that we've had five republics. The first one began in 1789. The second one began after the Civil War. The third one began certainly, I believe, under Richard Nixon, and forgotten the fourth one, but certainly the fifth one began on September 11th. In other words, with each turn, there was an increasing centralization of power in Washington, D.C. I'm sure the second was Woodrow Wilson, the third was FDR, the fourth was Richard Nixon, the fifth one was September 11th, which is used in excuse to expand government power over our lives, and that was what it was all about, because if you watch Building 7 come down, that was a controlled demolition, ladies and gentlemen, and if they lied about that, they lied about everything. Of course, we know they lied about what happened to Flight 93, because we're told the plane crashed down and nosed down and hit the ground there in Shanksville, but there's no records there. And, of course, we do know, of course, that the planes, other planes in the air, commercial airlines that morning, saw Flight 93 explode. And that fact has been totally suppressed from the American people. We can't let you know the truth. And the other thing is there was no significant records by the Pentagon. The government refuses steadfastly to release all the videos they have. They have all sorts of videos of what happened that morning. And the pictures they've released show absolutely nothing. Why are they suppressing the information? Because they cannot let the American people know that they murdered, they being what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness, they murdered almost 3,000 Americans that morning to justify getting us into a war, first with Afghanistan, and then with Iraq, And I think, I fear that before long, with the whole Muslim world, as they centralize power with Washington, D.C., and step by step they take away the freedom from the American people, of course, in the name of protecting us from the wicked terrorists who've been funded since their inception by our own intelligence agencies working in concert with the British intelligence, because they always work together. The Anglo-American establishment. Go right ahead, William.
That's exactly right. And the Anglo-American elite that we're talking about is best characterized, as Mr. Rockwell does here, as the banking military junta, that is to say, Wall Street and the military-industrial complex. And, of course, by banking, we're referring primarily to what I consider to be the focus of evil in the universe, which is the Federal Reserve System. And it's a question, a somewhat interesting ontological question here, as to whether the Federal Reserve was created in order to finance a war, or whether a war was created to justify the entrenchment of the Federal Reserve. But those developments were laid in stone in 1913, which is when Woodrow Wilson began his republic. These republics, by the way, have nothing in common with the Constitutional Republic that was created in 1789. However, deficient in some ways that arrangement had been, the Constitutional Republic that the founders created was of a completely different nature from what happened in the subsequent republics of 1861, 1913, 1933, and, of course, 2001. But in each instance, there was some great trauma that resulted in the controlled implosion, the controlled demolition of the previous regime. They go from one catastrophe to another, and they profit off of each of these catastrophes. And that's the nature of government. One of the reasons why it's important that people understand the fact that whatever happened, we will never know this side of eternity, I'm convinced, all the relevant details of what happened on the morning of September 11th. We know that we've been lied to in every relevant particular by the people who've capitalized on this for the purpose of controlling our lives even more intimately and enriching themselves at our expense. But what happened that morning was not a failure from the perspective of the people who rule us. There are some people who are critics of government. I think Lou Rockwell fits in this category, who refer to September 11th as Government Failure Day. And that's, I think, a useful way to look at it, at least in an initial sense. Because if you accept the claims of what happened on September 11th, it's a huge indictment of the system that they could spend $1 trillion on the world's most fearsome military arsenal. And at the time, they were spending hundreds of billions of dollars over the decades building up to 2001, in any case, on what was even then an invasive national security apparatus. And by their own account, if their account is to be credited, which I don't, you've got a system that is so inept and so porous that it could result in this catastrophe being brought about with minimal expense by a group of people who were cunning and materially deprived. That's their version of what happened, and yet what we are told is that because of that spectacular failure, as they describe it, they're entitled to get more power with less accountability. But this was not a failure. If you understand that government is the only human enterprise that profits from apparent failure, this was a resounding success. And that is why, over the next couple of days, we're going to have this passive-aggressive collective wallow in narcissistic self-pity on the part of the public that's supposed to be to the greater glory of those who rule us, because the full pomp and pageantry of this pernicious regime is going to be on display. It's going to be a celebration of its supposed might and goodness. And in the fashion of your stereotypical unctuous lounge singer, we're going to be told that we should applaud ourselves. There's that point in every drunken lounge singer performance at a bar or a club when he says, "Why don't you give yourself a hand?" Because, of course, that's something that will go over well with the audience. An audience likes to be stroked. They'll say, "Yeah, we deserve to give ourselves a round of applause because we're decent and good people." And that's pretty much the line that we're going to be getting over the next couple of days. We're going to celebrate our own supposed goodness and the bottomless evil of those who have been designated as the enemy by those who are actually responsible for our current predicament.
Well, I think that we carry a book. It's called See No Evil. It was written by Robert Baer, who spent the entire decade of the 1990s. This would have been, from It was the 1990s, after the first Gulf War, between the first Gulf War and the second Gulf War. He was actually in Kurdistan. He commented, he never met an Iraqi who did not believe the American government was keeping Saddam Hussein in power. Let me repeat that. He never met an Iraqi who did not believe that the American government was keeping Saddam Hussein in power. This is between the first Gulf War and the second Gulf War, but in the first chapter, or perhaps in the preface, he quotes one of the highest-ranking members of the CIA who told a friend of his off the record, when the dust finally settled after September 11th, the American people would realize that what happened on September 11th was not a failure of intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
It was a triumph of intelligence.
Exactly.
It was not a failure. It was a triumph. How could it be a triumph? 3,000 people died. Well, we have the book. You can read it, and you can arrive at your own conclusion, but it's there. It is never mentioned. It's never quoted. But the high-ranking CIA official who said, when the dust finally settles after 9-1-1, the American people will realize that what happened that day was not a failure of intelligence. It was a triumph. Go right ahead.
I read that, and I was thinking of that general insight, along with something that Dr. Johnson, Samuel Johnson, the English essayist, once wrote, when he said that no man is a hypocrite in his vices. You see what a man does with his discretionary time to enjoy himself, you get a pretty good idea of what he's really like. And I think that no regime is a hypocrite, if you will, in terms of the commendations it awards to people who are servants of the regime. And the fact that everybody involved in the upper echelons of the intelligence system here in the United States, who would have been indicted in a figurative, if not literal sense, for culpable failure because of what happened on 9/11. Every single person who is the policy-making position of responsibility was fated, promoted, and often given garlands and awards when, if you accept the current narrative, the established narrative of what happened, they should have been treated as pariahs. They should have been forced to resign en masse. In the British system, at least in the British system of several decades ago, it would have been understood that a failure, quote-unquote failure of this magnitude, would have been cause for the official responsible for that area of responsibility to resign as a matter of principle. If you take a look at what happens in the Japanese political system, if somebody is guilty of such a conspicuous and monumental failure, for instance, I'm thinking of an incident several years ago involving a plane crash in which a 747 was wiped out. This had been about 1985 or so. The head of the airline in Japan went to the families of the surviving family members of the victims, and he bowed in abject self-prostration, self-humiliation in front of these people, and then resigned because he understood that he had been responsible for a huge and epic failure that cost the lives of a number of, or at least that's how he depicted himself. I don't think he personally was responsible for the errors of judgment, the pilot errors, the mechanical breakdowns, but he was taking responsibility. And that's, of course, part of that culture. And in certain ancient cultures, it was understood that you'd fall on your sword if you fail so completely. But what happened was not a failure, as this unnamed but entirely plausible account of this unnamed CIA official shared with us by Robert Baer points out. This is not a failure. This is something that resulted in a not dramatic, but a substantial enhancement of the system that existed before 9/11. And what happened is that this was given the added benefit of complete impunity and complete lack of accountability, so that you have now 9/11 plus 10 years. You've got the regime involved in a half a dozen wars with no endpoint in sight. You've got the creation of this trillion-dollar monstrosity of the Homeland Security State. And you've got a new state of affairs in which our lives are supposed to be defined by the terrors and the fears that are provided to us by our masters. We're supposed to organize our lives around what they say should be the defining fear of the moment.
Let me just point out, we do carry that book. It's available from Radio Liberty. The book, once again, See No Evil by Robert Baer. See No Evil by Robert Baer. And, of course, we'll be back here in just a moment with William Grigg as we evaluate exactly what has happened. The legacy of 911 is to strip away our freedom. Go right ahead, William.
One of the things that I should point out, I mentioned Salon Magazine, this online journal, a few minutes ago, and the fact that they have been running a study series of articles in anticipation of the 9/11 commemoration. They had a piece a couple of days ago called The Enduring Mysteries of 9/11, and it's a piece that begins with the predictable and, I suppose, de rigueur slap at the truther movement, as if there's something disreputable about challenging the orthodox and prescribed set of opinions as to what happened on 9/11. And then they go into detail talking about a number of things, some of which represent, I think, genuine unanswered questions that should be investigated. For instance, what's in the 28 pages redacted from the 800-page report that was put together by the Joint House and Senate Intelligence Committee. There are 28 pages that have been withheld from public view that most likely deal with the involvement of the Saudis at some level that is uncomfortable in terms of their role in this orchestrated event, and the fact that the Saudis, of course, were indecently close to the Bush administration, the Bush family. The Bush family has been joined at the hip with the House of Saud for decades. That's an element of the story that should be looked into. Whether you subscribe to some version of the establishment's narrative or not, that's certainly something that should be looked into, if only because that's something that goes right to the heart of what's going on with the upper echelons of finance. With the petrodollar accord that Kissinger worked out in the early 1970s to keep the fiat dollar afloat, that's something that nobody really wants to look into who's interested in maintaining his political viability in the establishment. Are there other 9/11 conspirators, co-conspirators still at large? Well, that's an interesting question. Another interesting question is, are there any of the supposed 9/11 conspirators who we were told were killed on that morning, are any of them still alive? That's a question that people like Salon are not willing to look at because that would challenge the established narrative, and you simply don't do that. Who issued the shoot-down order? That's something that's worth looking into, as is the entire element of this story dealing with Flight 93, and as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, that's something that not many people have an appetite to address candidly and forthrightly. But at the end of the piece, we get this tantalizing little paragraph that I think is the real purpose of this article, and that has to do with positioning the public for the next war. Did Iran have any connection to the hijackers? That's a really interesting thing to dangle at the end of a piece that, of course, would lure people in with the tantalizing hints of critical disclosures. There's no evidence to suggest that the Islamic Republic of Iran played any direct or indirect role in the attack, let alone have any type of connections between the hijackers and Saudi Arabia. But the 9/11 Commission report did find, quote, strong evidence that Iran facilitated the transit of al-Qaeda members into and out of Afghanistan before 9/11, and that some of these were future 9/11 hijackers. Then it quotes Philip Zeiglau, executive director of the 9/11 Commission, who complains in the new afterword to the report that the commission asked the U.S. government to further examine Iran's pre-9/11 relationship with al-Qaeda. As far as know, this has not happened. So there's nothing there of substance that would connect Iran to 9/11. But the purpose of putting this in this article, and this is not the only article I've seen by any means, the Wall Street Journal has been teasing this supposed connection as well, is to start tuning the atmosphere for a war with Iran. And I think that one of the things that we're going to see come out of the forthcoming...
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with William Grigg. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is simply talking about this article in Salon Magazine. And, of course, as they get to the conclusion, of course, remember these articles are written for their psychological impact on your mind. They don't want you to think. They just want to plant ideas in your mind. And one of the ideas is, well, what was the relationship, certainly, between Iran and these terrorists who attacked America? And the inference is that Iran was really responsible for the attack, or at least they raised that as a possibility. And believe me, ladies and gentlemen, they keep doing this over and over and over again because they want at least as to perceive that Iran is a threat. And remember, of course, Iran had a democratically elected government. It was overthrown by the United States and our intelligence agencies in 1953. And Premier Mossadegh, who was the legitimate ruler of Iran, was kept at house arrest all the rest of his life. We took away his freedom. We took away his life. We took away their democratically elected government. We installed the Shah. And then in 1979, we got rid of the Shah, and he died shortly thereafter. And of course, we put the mullahs in power. And it was the CIA who installed the mullahs, who now, of course, we point out how terrible they are and how radical they are. Well, they were just this radical, exactly this radical, when we installed them. They knew exactly what they're doing. They just don't want the American people to understand that this is a game, and you topple one government, and you put another government in, and then you topple that government, and you replace it, and you topple that government, and replace it. And, of course, you always, of course, are moving us towards ever more into conflicts, one after another. Eventually, of course, they're going to result in another war. We're not sure where it is, when it is, but, of course, war increases the power of government and justifies ever more control over the lives of the American people. William, go right ahead.
Well, one of the things I would add to that is the fact that whatever you think of the government of Iran, which is, of course, a pretty loathsome government, it's exactly what you would expect, given its origin and given the role that has been played in some of the worst elements, both indigenously there in Iran and the elements that have been cultivated and nurtured by the Anglo-American spook network, if you will. Whatever you think of that government, the fact is that on 9/11 in 2001, the first reaction of that government was to express official sympathy for the United States. Then ruler President Khatami of Iran said, on behalf of the Iranian government and the nation, I condemn the hijacking attempts and terrorist attacks on public centers in American cities, which have killed a large number of innocent people. My deep sympathy goes out to the American nation, particularly those who have suffered from the attacks, and also the families of the victims. He went on to say that terrorism is doomed, and the international community should stem it and take effective measures in a bid to eradicate it. There was also an official moment of silence that was held in Iran, ordered by that government. I know that in some of the cities outside of Tehran, there were candlelight vigils that were spontaneous acts of compassion and sympathy on the part of Iranians who, for the most part, are not reflexively anti-American. Of course, there are rent-a-mobs of the employee of that government that will gather in the public square in Tehran and chant death to America, death to the great Satan on cue. But the rank-and-file Iranian citizenry is not anti-American, which is an amazing thing given everything the government of the United States has done to inflict perfectly horrible governments on that country for the last 50 years or so. As a competitor in judo and jiu-jitsu about 10 or 11 years ago, I spent a lot of time in the company of Iranians who are very good grapplers. They've got a very good grappling and wrestling culture there. My sensei was Iranian. His whole family was part of the dojo I was involved in. They were fairly recent immigrants from Iran. They were people who loved this country, and they loved Americans. As a matter of fact, I've never met an Iranian who didn't. And that's a remarkable thing, once again, given the history. But I think that what's happening here is that there is an effort being made, once again, to renew this long conflict that has been engineered and manipulated, as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, since 1953, in which the worst elements have been cultivated, nurtured, and put in power in Iran. And in the 1980s, you had Iran and Iraq set off against each other in a horrible war that killed millions of people. And you had the United States government actively supporting both sides at one time or another. And I see us being manipulated once again into a situation where tomorrow's commemoration is going to be used, I think, to help generate momentum in the direction of a catastrophic war with Iran. There's an obvious effort to set this up. It would be a perfectly horrible thing for the entire world, but that's not going to stop the people who specialize in the controlled demolition of human freedom.
I concur totally. And people must understand, ladies and gentlemen, that wars do not just happen. They are created, they are carefully orchestrated, they're planned. And I fear, of course, that suddenly what is going on today, they're planning another war. When? Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens.
What are the aspects of this upcoming collectivist self-pity wallow is the effort to cultivate this sense of helplessness on the part of the public. I mean, we're not talking about the type of an event that we would see if we were actually facing some kind of an existential threat from a ferocious and implacable enemy. If we were dealing with that type of enemy, the last thing that we would hear would be exhortations toward a type of Oprah-fied sentimentality where we're supposed to be feeling each other's pain. If we're dealing with people who could actually hurt us, then we would have leaders calling for resolution in the face of that enemy rather than holding hands and marinating ourselves in treacly self-pity. And that's just one element of this whole thing that this speaks to patent phoniness of what we're told. The fact that we're all but ordered to participate in this Feast of the Fallen Towers. And you pointed out something really interesting at the beginning of the program, Dr. Stan, about Mayor Bloomberg and the way that he's promoting this as a ritual of a civic religion and holding at arm's length the faith that has sustained most of the population of New York and most of the population of the United States since our inception, of course, which is Christianity, trying to hold that in abeyance while promoting this type of deracinated collectivist worship of the government and of the collective, and how this is, of course, something that's going to play into a really nasty narrative of a certain invidious prejudice that is being mobilized as well in the service of the same people who arrange all these conflicts for our benefit. But what's happening here is an effort to create a regular ritual every 5 years, every 10 years, perhaps every year in the future, into the foreseeable future, we're going to be called upon this time of year to take part in these public liturgies of self-pity on the part of the public and self-exaltation on the part of our rulers.
Hold that thought, William. We'll be back here as we bring our stations back on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Grigg, and certainly we're just talking about what we're going to be having in 2 days in New York. Mayor Bloomberg, who I consider an anti-Christian bigot, who actually discredits his own race and is doing everything he can to convince people that this is a vast Jewish conspiracy of people who hate Christianity. And most Jews are very, very tolerant of Christianity, recognizing that the freedoms they enjoy in America are a byproduct of the Christian religion, but not Mayor Bloomberg. He has his own agenda, and of course he has banned any mention of Christianity or prayer to the God of the Bible. Remember, it's still the God of Judaism and the God of Christianity is the same. Messiahs may be different, but the God is basically the same. And yet, of course, Mayor Bloomberg will not acknowledge the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament, certainly allow it even be mentioned at this celebration in his city. Well, anyway, William, before we go on, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get in your material, to get your blog site, and, Sydney, how they can get to your PayPal button, because, of course, William has a family, a large family. He's got the support, and he, of course, writes my monthly newsletter, for which we're indeed grateful, and we do help to support him. But if you're in a position to help to support him, I know he will appreciate it. Why don't you just mention how people can get to your blog and how people can get to your PayPal button?
Dr. Stan, I really appreciate that, and I'm grateful to everything you've done on our behalf. It's an honor to be asked to write your newsletter. I really appreciate that, too. My blog is called Pro Libertate, ProLibertate. The web address is freedominourtime.blogspot.com, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Or go to Google or some other search engine and just type in my name, William Grigg. And Pro Libertate, and the first return you should get if you use those search terms should be Pro Libertate, the blog. I try to update it a couple of times a week as opportunity presents itself. My current essay, which I think is also being republished at lewrockwell.com over the weekend, deals with a really interesting little incident that occurred when the cameras were off during the most recent presidential forum at the Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California, and I'll talk about that perhaps in just a second. But Pro Libertate is my chief outlet right now, and it's found at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I mentioned lewrockwell.com, lewrockwell.com. Mr. Rockwell, as I pointed out earlier, is the chairman, the head of the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. And lewrockwell.com is probably the most widely read libertarian or individualist website in the world. I contribute there a lot of my essays from Pro Libertate are republished there. I also contribute to the blog, which is located on the right-hand side of the screen at lewrockwell.com. I'm also involved in another venture, Republic Magazine. Republicmagazine.com is the web address for Republic Magazine. And we're working on the issue number 22 of Republic Magazine that should be available fairly soon. Issue number 21 has just come out. If you go to republicmagazine.com, you'll be able to find how to subscribe either in printed or digital form or both. And there are also a number of really fascinating DVD sets that are being offered by Republic Magazine on various subjects having to do with the Constitution, on various conferences that have been held, where you have a whole panoply of speakers and presenters dealing with various aspects of the freedom movement. Go to republicmagazine.com. There's some really fascinating stuff there for those who are interested in learning what's really going on in the world of politics, as well as health and nutrition and survivalism and emergency preparedness and all these relevant things that have to do with the management and stewardship of our lives. And Dr. Stan, you'd mentioned that I do have a PayPal button at the bottom of every essay that I publish at Pro Libertate, and I am very, very grateful to you and to your listeners who have contributed to our well-being, helped to keep our family afloat in these turbulent and timorous times. It's really quite a nasty environment that we find ourselves in, and I can't say honestly in any case that things are likely to get better at least anytime soon. And knowing that people are in straitened circumstances and have helped to keep my enterprise afloat is something that I consider to be very humbling and very rewarding. I'm grateful once again to you and to all those in your audience who have contributed to us. It's a very, very wonderful blessing for which we're eternally grateful.
We're glad to be able to help. Well, let's get back to the subject at hand here.
I mentioned just a minute or so ago that at the Pro Libertate blog this evening, and probably at lewrockwell.com, I have an essay talking about this little bit of peripheral business that occurred between Rick Perry and Ron Paul. There are some photographs that were published that were taken during a commercial break in which Rick Perry approached Ron Paul and actually laid his hands on Ron Paul and jabbed a finger in his face and appeared to be rebuking Ron Paul for saying things that were somewhat controversial and confrontational during the course of a debate. Well, a debate's supposed to be that way. A debate, of course, is an exercise in contradiction and confrontation. It's dialogue in which you have people in an adversarial setting expressing points of view. But the essay I wrote deals with two of the cowboy archetypes that I really find appropriate for this discussion from the works of Lou L'Amour, and how Rick Perry, for all of his superficial packaging as a rough-hewn, independent-minded cowboy, is very much a creature of the establishment. Ron Paul, whatever one thinks of his positions and his opinions, the way he expresses his opinions and so forth, he's very much his own man. He is a genuine maverick. That is to say, he's somebody who's not bearing the brand of somebody whose cattle penned him within a fenced-off area. In other words, he's somebody who freely roams the political landscape, saying what he believes to be the truth, as he's been given wisdom to understand the truth. And so the current essay, which is entitled "Where Have You Gone, Con Coniger," is an interesting title. I think some of your listeners, Dr. Stan, have probably read the book Coniger by Louis L'Amour, or seen the wonderful movie that came out about 20 years ago, starring Sam Elliott and his wife, Catherine Ross, and also one of the daughters of the late and very much missed Louis L'Amour. That's the essay that deals with this, and I think that's something that people will enjoy because it's a little bit lighter than a lot of what I write at Pro Libertate. A lot of what I write at Pro Libertate is in journalism of first instance, investigative reporting of the sort that focuses on really and often revoltingly infuriating developments in the lives of innocent people. I focus a lot on people who are victims of bullies, and I think if you wanted a handy one-phrase definition of my political perspective, it would be I can't stand bullies, and unfortunately politics is the realm of bullying. And that leads me to another subject I wanted to bring up this evening, and I touched on this last week, and that is the Jeremy Hill case here in Idaho. Briefly to review, Jeremy Hill is a young father. He has six children, as I have. He's had them in a much more compressed time frame. However, he's younger than I am. He got started earlier, and he had children very quickly. They live in Boundary County, Idaho, which is up in the northernmost extremity of Idaho, the panhandle. He lives near a town called Bonner's Ferry. And on Mother's Day last May, he was at home with four of their six kids, and three bears wandered onto his property. These are grizzly bears. For those who don't understand what a grizzly bear is, imagine a one ton of fast twitch muscle fiber and predatory impulse that is ponderous enough to crush you simply by running over you, but capable of accelerating the speeds of 40 miles an hour and making hairpin turns of the sort that would leave a free safety from the NFL with broken ankles. That's what a grizzly bear is like. These are not Disneyfied, anthropomorphized animals that like to ride unicycles and play soccer. This is nature red in tooth and claw. A grizzly can render somebody my size, I'm a fairly large guy, somebody my size into a stack of bloody fajitas within an instant. There were three of these feral predators that transgressed the property line of the Jeremy Hill family because, of course, bears, being of a lower order of creation, don't understand property rights. And so the children were shooed into the house, and Jeremy Hill went out to confront the bears. Only one of them was an immediate danger, so Jeremy Hill shot that bear. The other two took off, ran off into the wilderness, leaving the third bear wounded. Now, you don't want to leave a wounded grizzly on your property or anywhere near it. So Jeremy called the local fish and game officials and said that he had shot a bear. And, of course, what they would have done is if they had arrived in a timely fashion, they would have walked out to the bear and they would have delivered the coup de grace. They wouldn't have let that bear suffer, and they wouldn't have let him recover and then perhaps retaliate against the family. They would have killed the bear. They didn't arrive soon enough to do that, so Jeremy did this for himself. The fish and game officials showed up, investigated the case, said it appears to be a perfectly legitimate case of defending yourself, your property, and your family from this feral predator. The Boundary County prosecutor, who didn't have any official role in the investigation, conducted his own inquiry and vindicated Mr. Hill, saying what he did was entirely appropriate, proportionate, and necessary. Unfortunately, Idaho, like every other state in the SOUs, is afflicted with the presence of federal prosecutors. I wish that weren't the case. If I were the governor of Idaho, that would not be the case. The federal government's got no business investigating crimes. Apart from one or two specifically mentioned offenses under the Constitution, they have no jurisdiction over criminal law. They shouldn't be causing trouble for people who live in the various states. Unfortunately, that's not the case. Wendy Olson is the commissarina representing the People's Republic of Washington, D.C. here in the state of Idaho. For reasons that have to do most likely with her own ambitions and the perverse incentives of her feculent little fraternity, she decided to prosecute Jeremy Hill under the Endangered Species Act, claiming that what he did constituted an illegal taking of a bear. Now, the reason she did this, as I mentioned before, it has to do most likely with the way that people are promoted within the so-called Justice Department, but the reason that she preferred charges against, or at least threatened to take him to court and prosecute him with the prospect of several thousand dollars of fines and perhaps a year in prison for defending his family, is so she could extort from him some kind of a deal that would validate the Endangered Species Act as legitimate law within the state of Idaho, which, of course, it isn't. The Endangered Species Act is utterly spurious, is patently unconstitutional. The federal government's got no authority, no constitutional jurisdiction over any of the land in the state of Idaho. It certainly does not own the wildlife or livestock or chattels of any kind. The Endangered Species Act, Dr. Stan, as you like to point out, is a product of a theological view that is rooted in a rejection of Genesis. And more importantly, for those who don't believe in the book of Genesis, what it says about man being the apex creation of the created order, if you don't subscribe to that, you probably subscribe to property rights. I don't see how you can believe in property rights if you don't believe in a creator, but even if you don't believe in a creator, you probably believe in property rights. The Endangered Species Act completely nullifies the concept of property rights, private property. It essentially says that that human beings have no more important role in nature than any other species, except for those enlightened, exalted few who know how the world should run and have been, I guess, placed by history with the special anointing of Gaia to define how we are going to conduct our affairs with respect to the non-sentient species that surround us. And so, presumably, the federal government owns the land and it owns all the wildlife. The earth is the government's and the fullness thereof. And so it was improper for Jeremy Hill to kill that bear because he wasn't wearing the habiliments of the government's priesthood. He wasn't wearing a state-issued costume, and he didn't have license to do this. And so he should have waited and exposed his family to danger while duly authorized agents of the government showed up and took care of that bear. And in order to validate this, it was necessary to have him punished somehow, because otherwise people might start having transgressive thoughts about the lack of validity of the Endangered Species Act and the complete illegitimacy of the regime in terms of the way that lands are administered here in the state of Idaho. Governor Butch Otter, who's almost as patently phony as a cowboy as Rick Perry, wrote a mewling, sycophantic letter to Ken Salazar, who's the Secretary of the Interior, asking that he be measured and judicious in conducting the prosecution of Jeremy Hill. What he said basically was that, and I'm quoting now from that letter, there is great public outcry about this issue, and prosecution may further damage community support for recovery efforts. In other words, the really important thing here is not to make people too angry in making an example of this man. Be gentle. Do what you must do in order to uphold and validate the supposed authority of the Endangered Species Act, but don't turn this man into a martyr. Well, just a couple of days ago, Wendy Olson made a deal with Jeremy Hill. Bear in mind, once again, this is a man of limited means. Unlike Wendy Olson, he doesn't have a bottomless reservoir of money extorted from taxpayers in order to deal with court costs. So he agreed that his actions violated a portion of the Endangered Species Act, which, of course, they didn't, and he paid a $1,000 fine. So she got her pound of flesh. The Endangered Species Act was preserved and upheld. Jeremy Hill won't be going to prison. But the unfortunate thing here, once again, is that just as Butch Otter had requested, you have a resolution that helps further entrench the Endangered Species Act. Now, one of my readers pointed out in a letter that I received not long ago that you have six children who are threatened by a wounded grizzly. He was forced to pay a $1,000 fine. $1,000 divided by six is $166.67. The value of life of a U.S. citizen on this calculation is $166.67. Now, that's an interesting way of running the math and crunching the numbers, but the point is, we don't matter to them at all. That's one of the lessons that we learned when you take a look at misanthropic measures like the Endangered Species Act. That's a lesson that we learn as we take a look at the way our country is being converted into basically a huge pot of resources and money to be plundered at the whim of the banking oligarchy and the military-industrial complex, the way that American soldiers are fed into a meat grinder of perpetual war for reasons that have nothing to do with defending the country or defending our freedoms. And that's the lesson of what happened on 9/11. The fact is that those people who died on 9/11, however this came about in terms of the details, were offered as a sacrifice to this malevolent Molech that is the government that presumes to rule us. And the smoke that ascended from the towers, including, of course, the World Trade Center number 7, the smoke that ascended that day was visible from orbit. I just saw some dramatic footage the other day of some of the film that was captured from the International Space Station. The smoke that ascended from those towers was a pleasing incense in the nostrils of the Molech that rules us. And that's why we're being told to take part in this obscene, blasphemous celebration of the next couple of days. And that's a liturgy in which I have no interest. You know, that's not the God before whom I am inclined to kneel. And that's one of the reasons why people like Mr. Bloomberg want to have nothing to do with recognition of the sovereign God of the universe at that event on Sunday.
Amen to that. Well, I guess it's been William Grigg. I hope you enjoy the conversation. William does most of the talking, but his ideas are valid. And understand, ladies and gentlemen, behind everything going on are powerful spiritual forces. That is why Mayor Bloomberg doesn't want any mention of God or of Christ at this celebration. William, we've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program, and then we'll let you go. And, of course, we will talk to you not next Friday, but next Thursday.
Next Thursday, exactly. Well, thank you once again, Dr. Stan. It's always a pleasure and always an honor for me to be on your program. I think that one of the things that I find comforting and for which I take strength and solace is the knowledge that there are people willing to talk about these subjects as candidly as we do, and there are people willing to listen to what we have to say. And that the other people you have on your program, Dr. Stan, bring their expertise and their passion to all these troubling subjects that we really have no choice but to examine, in which we must immerse ourselves in order to prepare ourselves for what we see unfolding in real time.
Let me just share something with you. We have a friend over there in Israel, and she just sent me an email this week telling me that she talked to several people over in Israel who listened to our program regularly and said to me how much they appreciate it. I talked to a woman this last week who listened to our program regularly in Chile. We are reaching people, and so the programs you do with us are being heard all over the world. We know we have listeners in Europe, we have listeners in Africa, in New Zealand, Sydney, in Australia. We have a unique opportunity never available to any group of people before now, through the miracle of the Internet, to reach people throughout the world. And although Internet certainly, the computer is a two-edged sword, why we want to use our side, because for the first time we have a means of disseminating the truth. You have 1 minute to wrap up the program.
Like I said, that's a source of great comfort and solace to me, is the knowledge that not only do we have people in America who are still the sort of people who bear the impress of our founding generation, but there are people around the world whose souls resonate like tuning forks when the truth is spoken to them. We've seen that Ron Paul has managed to reach out to that same cohort as well. There is a universal impulse within the human being, human beings of all backgrounds, toward freedom and to understand the truth. It's something that was written on our hearts by our Creator. It's part of our moral operating system. And the fact that there are people still willing to recognize that and do what they can in order to validate those truths, once again, is something for which I am very, very grateful.
And I think there's a growing awareness, even among the traditional Americans, that something's seriously wrong. And we'll just keep hammering away week after week, month after month, as long as God gives us breath, until we are no longer allowed to do this, or until God is ultimately victorious in whatever way he's going to let this play out. William, thank you so very much for being with us, and we look forward to talking to you next Thursday evening at the same time.
God bless you, Dr.
And you too. Bye-bye. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We do hope you enjoy our weekly conversations with William Griggs, certainly one of the most articulate of spokesmen on our side. So understand, ladies and gentlemen, that there really is a spiritual battle going on. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, shame on you. If you don't want to buy the book, go to our website, radioliberty.com, and you can watch the DVD there for nothing. In fact, most of our DVDs are posted there, and we think they're important enough that we recommend them to you. I recommend specifically my talk on the World Revolution. That is the World Revolution, where you'll see my interview with Ambassador Smith, the American ambassador to Cuba at the time that Fidel Castro came to power. And he will tell you things that no one else will ever tell you about Fidel Castro. And then, of course, my talk on Iraq, the untold story. My talk on the forbidden secret. My talk on the dark secret. My talk on planned population reduction. You need to get this information, or you need to get it to others. And then, of course, as a foundation, my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. If you want certainly the same story, about five times as long, you want to get Ted Flynn's book, The Hope of the Wicked. That's The Hope of the Wicked. And then I need to mention that my ministry, Radio Liberty, is primarily listener-supported, and if you're in a position to help us, we'd love to hear from you. We have about 65 outlets every single week, and we do need your help to be able to continue to pay the stations, most of the stations that we do pay at least something, so that we can continue getting the word out. And so if you're in a position to help us, why, our number is 1-800-544-8927. I should mention we have an opportunity to pick up an excellent station in Southern California. Joyce Riley, Butch Parr, are already on the station. And when we're there with them, why, we're going to have a tremendous outreach. If you're in a position to make a pledge for 6 months, or simply to a one-time pledge, or if you're not able to, we ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. The station is KMET, I believe it's down close to Riverside in a place called Banning, but we're hoping to be starting there next week. So if you're in a position to help us, our number 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. But we build certainly our structure of our ministry one step at a time. And people all across America are beginning to understand that we're involved in a spiritual battle, being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. But it is a spiritual battle, and there really are organized spiritual forces on the other side, not imaginary, but they are there. There really are people out there who do worship a different God. And until you understand that, none of this makes sense. So we do hope that, of course, you'll get my talks. We touch this on many of our talks. It's a recurrent theme of my ministry. And then, of course, we certainly hope you want to get my talk on Iraq, the Untold Story. Iraq, the Untold Story. And then, of course, we hope that you'll tell others about our ministry. We caution you to make preparations for the difficult times that do lie ahead. We do carry the Berkey products, the Miracle 2 soap products. We carry health products that we think are good. In fact, almost all those we offer are things that Barbara and I use regularly. In fact, I was just noticing that we have the virgin coconut oil. Certainly we do a lot of cooking in that because, of course, it's an excellent oil. It's certainly the safflower oil and the canola oil and the vegetable oils that they're trying to get you to use are terrible for your heart and terrible for your health, whereas olive oil and virgin coconut oil, wonderful, and things like this are available from Radio Liberty. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 if you'd like a list of the various health products which we think are so important. Why? Call us at 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. So until Monday, may the Lord be with you.